The following program is a presentation of the Jewelry Exchange and Auction.
Did you know that nothing in life is certain except death and taxes? And, well, sometimes, not even taxes. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? I'm David Bluestein.
And I'm Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction in San Antonio.
We're here each Saturday morning at 7 o'clock to provide an insider's view on the world of jewelry, coins, antiques, collectibles, and much more. As owners and operators of the Jewelry Exchange and Auction in Stone Oak, we're on the front line with a finger on the pulse of these markets every day, and as of right now, you have a friend in the business. Yes, nothing in life is certain except death and taxes, and sometimes not even taxes. Today on our Insider Report, you'll get the inside story on how smart people handle personal property and structure their affairs to avoid, or at least to minimize, tax liabilities and financial complications that occur after death. We'll be talking to Glenn Yale of the Yale Law Firm, and we'll be answering your questions on the subject of death and taxes. But first, what a week.
What a week. Last Saturday, we had a great auction. We sold a bunch of classic U.S. gold coins, military knives, rifles. We sold two Lincoln cents, one for $950 and one for $1,800. Those were Lincoln cents, but they were the right Lincoln cents.
The right Lincoln cents. Don't start looking in your pocket. You're not going to find them.
We sold some one-carat diamonds for wholesale prices. I sold a real fox fur coat for $25. We got a consignment of 40 pounds of James Avery, Tiffany, David Yurman, John Hardy, Pandora, Judith Ripka, and on and on and on. We weeded out a lot of the fakes because there's some fakes in every batch that we see. But so we can offer just the authentic merchandise. And so this week I have some great authentic designer jewelry. We're going to be starting at just the metal price. Rolex, Cartier, Invicta, a lot of other nice watches, and of course all the James Avery, Tiffany, David Yurman, John Hardy. You know, just check it out for yourself at jewelryexchangeandauction.com or come to our gallery, 19903 Stone Oak Parkway, Suite 206. We're in San Antonio. We're open Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. We're having the auction live tonight. Champagne at 6 p.m. and the auction's at 7.
Yeah, although I hate to be a name dropper, allow me to drop some names. Adam mentioned Tiffany. Tonight, 15 pieces of Tiffany, authentic Tiffany, guaranteed to be authentic, as opposed to a lot of that merchandise out there that's just no good. 6 pieces of Yurman, 8 pieces of John Hardy, 44 pieces of James Avery jewelry, but we spent a good part of the afternoon yesterday going through about 2,000 James Avery charms that we'll be selling within the next few weeks with no reserve whatsoever.
Yeah, how many charms does it take to reach 40 pounds?
I mean, if James Avery corporate office, they're going to see a little sales slump over the next few weeks and say, what happened? But everything comes to an end, but we're going to sell those thousands just as fast as we can. Ann King, Barbara Bixby, Bora, I think Adam mentioned the Rolex, and actually, Adam, you're working on a big Rolex deal right now, right?
Yes, I'm working on some people are offering me a constant stream of Rolexes. I have the first four that they've consigned are going to be next week. We got some legal carved ivory tusks. They're monstrous. They have African designs, and it's going to be really cool.
Federal law puts major restrictions on buying and selling ivory. For example, you have to be able to prove whether it was African ivory or Indian ivory, when was the animal taken, when did the piece enter the country? And we and most people who are concerned about whether the feds come knock down their door or not have decided a long time ago to just stop dealing in ivory. But in this case, these are some tremendous pieces with all the required
That's
paperwork.
Right.
So we're going to offer those very soon. You know, if we sound excited, it's because we are. We must be doing something right because it's working. And, of course, all the time, we hope you folks will come up and join us in Stone Oak tonight for the 7 o'clock auction. Let's go to the trivia quiz. It's time for the In the Money trivia quiz, the quiz where you win the answer. Before we go to the new quiz, let's review last week's quiz and find out what the answer was.
Well, last week I asked a gemstone question, and this was the question. Beryl, spelled B-E-R-Y-L, comes in many colors and is mined in North America, South America, and Africa. Green beryl is commonly known as emerald. And the question is, what is the common name for the light blue beryl variety? That, of course, is aquamarine. And this week we had three winners: Frank Schultz, Melissa Kruger, Paula Ramirez. The prize this week, 5-carat fancy-cut aquamarine for each of you. If you are one of the winners, please come to Jewelry Exchange and Auction at our gallery at 19903 Stone Oak Parkway within the next 30 days to claim your prize. Our gallery is open Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Saturday evenings for our live auction. For more information, click on the Contact Us tab on our website at jewelryexchangeandauction.com. And David, you have a new question for us this week?
Yeah, here's this week's question. Until the South African Krugerrand, the Canadian Maple Leaf, the American Eagle gold coin came out, and other even increment 1 troy ounce gold coins, the Mexican gold peso series was one of the most popular ways to own bullion-related coins. There were also British sovereigns and 100 coronas and 4 ducats, all of them kind of oddball weights. But the at least the Mexican gold peso series was easy enough to predict because, you know, for example, if you had 220 pesos and a 10 peso, that was the same as the 50 peso. And so at least it made some sense. In fact, the gold peso series is still rather popular in South Texas for obvious reasons. Now, the largest coin in the Mexican gold peso series is the Centenario, the 50 peso coin that contains 1.2 ounces of pure gold. And although the last date on these 50 peso coins is 1947, the 1947 dies were used by the Mexican Mint to strike coins for several years past that date. Currently, the Centenario is worth about $2,000, which is just for the gold. It's not a collectible piece, but that's a pretty good chunk of gold.
Sure.
This week's question. The smallest coin in the series is not the 1 peso coin. What is it? What's the smallest coin in the Mexican gold peso series? To be a winner this week, all you have to do is to be the very first person to email the correct answer to quiz@inthemoneyradio.com. That's quiz@inthemoneyradio.com. You can also submit your answer directly from our homepage at www.inthemoneyradio.com. Then listen to next week's show to see if we read your name on the air. If we do, come claim your prize. I wonder what it is.
Sounds like you're giving away some free gold.
I'm not going to say. I don't want you entering the contest and winning. But come claim your prize at the Jewelry Exchange on Stone Oak Parkway in the next 30 days. You can enter as often as you like, but please, only one winner per household per month. We know we have a lot of regulars who regularly know the answers. But come on, guys, give somebody else a chance. Sometimes we get answers from people who just want us to know they knew the answer, even though they know they don't qualify. Remember the email address, quiz@inthemoneyradio.com, quiz@inthemoneyradio.com. Good luck. Now let's take a short commercial break. Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Hi, I'm David Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction and co-host of KLUP's In the Money. When you want a new car, you don't drive your old car to the junkyard. When it's time to move, you don't sell your old house for firewood. So why would you treat your old jewelry that way? Your unwanted valuables aren't scrap. At the Jewelry Exchange and Auction, up to 25,000 qualified bidders from all over the world compete for your unwanted valuables at our live auctions. We also need your coins and currency, firearms, and almost any unwanted valuable. Sell it on the spot or auction it for even more money. What's in your closet? Get more at the Jewelry Exchange and Auction in San Antonio. Texas license number 16604, member of the Better Business Bureau. Call 210-592-8786 or visit jewelryexchangeandauction.com. Jewelryexchangeandauction.com. And join us every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. for In the Money right here on KLUP. You're back with David and Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction on In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it?
You know, in my normal day-to-day dealings with dealers and even the public, I see people breaking tax laws all the time. I'm almost a little reluctant to say that. I'm not going to name any names. But I just want to clear some things up just in case you don't know this. That I know that nobody wants to pay taxes. No, I don't want to pay taxes, but we're going to not break the law, so we're going to pay as little as we can. One example is in Texas. If you own a home, you can name a homestead. You can claim it as your homestead and get a property tax exemption. But that's not really what I'm going to be talking about. But I also have a funny story here. That my wife is from Vietnam, which is a communist country, and she wasn't particularly interested in politics. But after we received our first tax bill and she started to understand how all that works, she's now a Republican.
Although I think the Republicans could share a lot of blame for the mess we're in now. But in any case, we've always promised not to talk about politics or religion, but somehow when you buy and sell gold and silver for a living, you end up talking politics quite a bit.
But I'm going to talk more about what we deal in at the Jewelry Exchange and Auction, what kind of tax situations arise commonly. On most purchases that anybody is ever going to make, they're going to have to pay sales tax. In Texas, you pay the Texas state sales tax 8 1/8%, or 8.125%.
Although that's different in different neighborhoods even, but where we are up in Stone Oak, it's 8.125% for most property.
In Alaska, many places, no sales tax,
Many states have that.
And in California, up to 9.75%, believe it or not.
I knew there was one reason why I left, among others.
I heard on the radio recently that they said that Texas state sales tax possibly increasing. But I'm not sure. Maybe when you guys know more about that. But anyway, if you are a business owner and you have a tax ID number, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, you should be collecting sales tax. And if you do collect sales tax, you also have to pay it to the state. You don't want to mess around with the state and sales tax.
Well, we saw a couple of different businesses right near us in Stone Oak who were shut down by the state for collecting, yet not turning that over to the state.
Oh, they'll shut you down in a second.
Yep.
But otherwise, if you can take advantage of some different tax exemptions. One, for example, very common, is that if you are buying bullion or numismatics, that means gold bars, gold coins, or even collectible coins.
Or currency.
The total of your purchase is over $1,000, the state will consider that an investment, and you don't pay sales tax on that. Very common, a lot of people take advantage of this. If you were going to buy some bullion and you wanted to spend $500 every week, I would tell you, why don't you spend $1,000 every 2 weeks and not pay the 8 1/8% sales tax?
When you consider that our profit margin on most of these bullion deals is around 2%, what a shame to give us 2% and then over 8% to the state. If you can avoid doing that, you really should. You know, it's always kind of puzzles me that the state considers it an investment if you spend $1,000 or more. But if you spend less than that, it's not an investment. You know, in some states, the sales tax is actually called end user's tax. Because I understand if I buy a loaf of bread and I eat it, I am the end user. But if I buy bullion and I'm not going to make something out of it. I'm going to sell it later, hopefully for more money than I paid for it. And I don't really know why I should be taxed on that.
That's a good point.
It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. You know, it doesn't even make sense to me that I should be taxed on a used car. I mean, I bought the new car, I paid sales tax on it, and now I sell it again. again, you know, I resell it and someone has to pay sales tax, and they resell it and someone has to pay sales tax. It's almost as if the state is just looking for reasons to get money out of you.
No,
I don't believe it either, but it's almost like that.
But yeah, in those cases, the estate makes more money on those bullion purchases than we do, and we did all the work and took all the risk. But we're doing deals for 1%, 2%, even 3% sometimes, so 8 1/8% too much. That when we accept payment for these bullion deals, we can really only accept cash or bank wire. Those are the only two payment forms of payment that are not reversible. If you were going to do a large purchase and spend more than $10,000 and pay in cash, now anytime anybody, even a bank, transfers more than $10,000 cash, they must file a form with the Department of Homeland Security. Since in the 3 years that we've been doing this at San Antonio, I've done this once because most people don't want the paper trail.
Yeah, we do a lot of deals for $9,900. There's nothing illegal about it, but people in our business just don't want the government to know what they're doing, and it's not none of the government's business, really. At least the way I read the Constitution, and they're thinking back to the 1930s when the federal government decided that private citizens couldn't own gold anymore. And they're saying, well, if the government doesn't know I have the gold, it can't find out. So we do a lot of $9,900 deals with Mr. and Mrs. Smith and Mr. and Mrs. Jones, and we have no obligation to know who we're selling that merchandise to. If they pay in cash, there is no trail. Of course, when we buy the merchandise back, we have to satisfy Texas state law and get good ID and keep that in our record book for 2 years and make that available to law enforcement if they ask. Adam, I wanted to read something off the IRS website about when a Form 8300 has to be filed. And, of course, that's for business and trade of cash payments of more than $10,000. In fact, it's $10,000 or more. I guess I found a typo on the IRS website. It's $10,000 or more to the Fed. The form has to be filed. And it's not just when you're buying and selling something. It's not just for the sale of goods or services. Making or repaying a loan, reimbursement of expenses, rental of real or personal property, exchange of cash for other cash. Well, that sounds like money laundering, doesn't it? sale of real property and sale of intangible property. When $10,000 changes hands in cash between Americans, a Form 8300 has to be filed. And that's sent to the IRS, and it says the information contained in the form assists law enforcement in its anti-money laundering efforts. Well, yeah, and then it continues. When businesses comply with the reporting laws, they provide authorities with an audit trail to stop tax evasion, bingo, drug dealing, terrorist financing, and other criminal activities. I mean, it's not that I think that that's a bad idea or anything, but people need to know that. And you can't beat it by making a $100,000 deal with us today and paying for it in cash over the next 10 days. And you can't beat it by making two $5,000 deals with us today and paying cash for each. It's $10,000 or more exchanged for a single transaction or in a single day. And any attempt to get around that law is going to be quite obvious to what you're trying to do. So if some our customers who want to spend $100,000, they're at the whim of the market. They're at the mercy of the market. They can make a commitment today and pay for it today, and we'll deliver it. They can make a commitment tomorrow, pay for it tomorrow, and we'll deliver it. But these can't be interdependent transactions.
Right, that's true. But there is a way, just in case you're wondering, there is a way to do it completely anonymously, legal, and most of all, no tax. Another way to purchase merchandise with no tax is you have to have a resale certificate. You must keep one on file. I don't want a copy of your license. You have to fill out the form. And even if you do have a resale certificate, if you, for example, are in the car business, that doesn't mean that that you can pay no tax when you buy jewelry. I'm not the tax police, but at some point I think that somebody might get in trouble.
Well, that's exactly why the person claiming sales tax exemption has to fill out a form and make some declarations. Just some people say, well, here's a copy of my sales tax permit. And no, that's not good enough, because on the declaration form, it says that you're in the business of buying and selling what? And now when you're about to do business with this merchant, in their case, us, what will you be buying and selling? So if you're a spaghetti farmer and you're in a business of buying and selling spaghetti and related commodities, and you claim that you say you're buying jewelry and coins from us, well, there's no exemption there. So in a way, the state is asking you to fill out that form and maybe hang yourself or commit fraud one way or the other. So even if you do have a sales tax permit that entitles you and obligates you to collect and pay that tax, you really have to consider whether you're the end user or not.
And that's the other thing, that if you're the end user or not. I'm a diamond professional, and if I have a sales tax number, if I buy diamonds that I intend to resell, I don't pay sales tax. But if I buy a microscope to grade those diamonds, I'm not reselling that microscope. I am the end user. I'm the one that's using the microscope. I have to pay sales tax on that microscope. I'm not sure a lot of people realize that. But otherwise, if you buy it with the intention of reselling it and you actually deal in that kind of merchandise, you can pay no tax on that merchandise. Another example that comes up when we're dealing in currency and coins is that the face value of coins and currency is not taxable. If I sell you a collectible $20 bill and you pay $21 on it, 20 of the dollars, the face value, is not taxable, regardless of who you are. So if I sell you a $20 bill for $21, you pay tax on $1.
What a pain in the neck trying to get your software to comply with that.
Yeah, please don't make me do that.
You know, we have, I think, one customer who's aware of that law and makes us comply, and that's 13-year-old Chucky Buchel, who was here a couple weeks ago with us. And Chucky just knows the law, and to him, he doesn't want to pay 8.125 cents on the dollar if he doesn't have to. So whenever Chucky checks out after the auction, we have to do this complex computation. Sometimes I just want to give him the merchandise so I don't have to think about that and have to calculate that.
And the only other example that I can think of, and unless, David, you can think of another, is that if you are out of state, like, for example, we simulcast our auctions online. People out of state and even all over the world are participating in our auctions. And when we ship something anywhere outside of Texas, the person that purchased that, regardless of who they are, does not pay state sales tax.
Right. You know, people ask us all the time when they're selling us something. Usually it's after they sign the paper and we're preparing to pay them. They say, do I have to pay taxes on the money that you pay me? And we make it clear to them, we're not tax advisors. We can't really give them advice on that. They should consult their tax professional. But, you out there in radio land and we are such old friends, let's have just a little discussion among friends here. The easy answer is that whenever you sell something for more than what you paid for it, you owe taxes on it. The government wants their share.
You owe taxes on the profit.
On the
that
profit
you,
of
that
it.
Made, right?
On the profit. You know, usually with jewelry, there is no profit.
Well, yeah. If you listen to our What's Your Jewelry Worth show that we did a few weeks back on inthemoneyradio.com, you can stream all the old shows. You'll know just what I'm talking about. Jewelry, you are probably not going to make money on that, so there would be no capital gain.
But, you know, for the most part, though, if you did make money on anything, the sale of a car, the sale of a, I don't know, rusty old nail. I mean, the government wants their share, and that's called capital gains taxes. And, you know, there's two kinds of capital gains. There's a long term and a short term. If you hold something for more than a year, then that's considered long term capital gain. If you flip it in less than a year, well, that's a short term gain. And so very often people have to be cognizant, aware of when they bought something and how long they've been holding it. It's true for stocks and bonds, and it's certainly true for personal property too, hard assets. Right now, the long-term rate, I don't know if there are exceptions, but I think in general, or more specifically, that the long-term rate is 15% of the profit goes to the federal government, and the short-term rate is charged as if it's ordinary income to you, whatever, it just goes in the pot of any other money that you might have made working or any other non-special income that you got, and it's taxed at the regular rate. And, you know, this discussion about the Bush tax cuts and the rate that Romney pays in taxes is largely related to the fact that his money comes from long-term capital gains and isn't even the Warren Buffett question about him paying less tax rate than his secretary pays. Well, the money she makes is probably all or almost all from ordinary income, from her wages, and the money he makes is certainly mostly, if not all, from his long-term capital gains, and that's just a different tax rate. So you can't be mad at the rich for paying a lower tax rate. If you want to be mad at someone, get mad at Congress and tell them to change the laws. And this threat to rescind or let expire the Bush tax cuts, you know, when the Democrats control the presidency, and both parts of you know, the House of Representatives and the Senate, they had a chance to take. Why would some of the richest people in America not want those tax cuts to expire, even when they have the chance? You know, like I say, we're in a mess in this country, but it's not. You can't blame any one party on it, but that's my point. You can't blame any one party for that. So anyway, why some of the richest people in America don't want that capital gains tax to change? That's a mystery to me, right? Hey, that music means we're up against a hard break. KLUP is about to take you away for a couple of messages, but we're not going anywhere. We'll be right back with Glenn Yale of the Yale Law Firm. Don't go away. You're listening to In the Money with David and Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction. You're back with Adam and David Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction on In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? Our special guest today, Glenn Yale of the Yale Law Firm. Welcome, Glenn. Thanks for joining us on In the Money.
I'm thrilled to be here.
Glenn, we were talking in the green room. You told us this had nothing to do with what we're going to talk about today, but you were telling us that yesterday has some special meaning for you back in Ohio, right?
Right. I was raised in Auglaize County, and that was the county that Neil Armstrong was born in. And yesterday was his funeral. And the highlight of my years in high school was marching in the Neil Armstrong homecoming parade.
That's cool.
When he came back from the moon.
That's cool.
And that was a thrill. Bob Hope was in the parade, and Ed McMahon, the new spokesman for Budweiser Beer, was also in the parade.
That's cool.
It was terrific.
That's cool. Glenn, you're an estate planning and probate attorney, and I've got to say, reading your resume, I'm tickled by the fact that your name is Glenn Yale and you went to Harvard. I mean, I'm not the first one to mention that, right?
You are not. we lived on Oxford Street in Cambridge when I was going to law school.
Oh.
And I joke that my wife had a cat, and she got it neutered and called it William and Mary. So we had a lot of connections there.
So tell me something. We just mentioned Harvard. What type of training does it take to prepare for a career, estate planning and probate attorney?
Well, it takes training as an attorney. You need a law license, and then you need to practice quite a few years in the area. It involves drafting wills and trusts. It involves probating wills, practice before the probate court.
So you became an attorney and then apparently decided to specialize in this.
Yes, I practiced 30 years in this particular area of the law.
And so that's where you belong. That's where you want to be. You know, I always wonder, when we die, why can't we just give things to our heirs without the government getting involved? I mean, if I just bury my stuff in the backyard and Adam just digs it up after I die, is that illegal or unethical or immoral or something?
Well, there are laws that impose certain taxes on the privilege of transferring property. Now, it used to be many years ago, back when I was first practicing, those taxes became imposed when you had an estate of $125,000. Huh. Now,
but $125,000 used to be real money.
Well, it used to be real money, but a lot of people were caught up in that tax. Today, if somebody passed away today, they can have an estate of up to $5.1 million, and they're not going to be taxed by the federal government.
And so when we talk about a death tax or an inheritance tax, is that what we're talking about? That with an estate worth $5.1 million, the federal government will get none of that?
That's correct.
5.1.
And for a couple, that gets doubled. So they can have $10.2 million, and they need not pay any estate tax at all.
So all I got to do is meet somebody with $10.2 million, and I could say, hey, you're going to get taxed if they're over that limit.
Only if they're over that limit do they have to worry about the federal government stepping in.
And we mentioned something about the what's called considered popularly as the Bush tax cuts. That has something to do with the inheritance tax, too, not just the capital gains rates, right?
That's correct. The Bush tax cuts established stepped increases in the exempt amount that were phased in, and they resulted in the complete repeal of the estate tax. However, that was phased out in 2011 and 2012, and we got the $5.1 million exemption instead. But that even disappears under the so-called Bush tax cuts. And on January 1, 2013,
uh-oh,
if nothing is done,
uh-oh,
that exempt amount goes to $1 million.
And so I know that there's posturing by both parties about who's going to do what to whom if as a result of what, but what's your take on this? Do you think it's a pretty safe bet that nobody in Congress really wants to see these cuts expire?
Well, there are some that do want to see them expire.
A small minority, I think, in all reality.
I think it is a small minority, and we have something coming up called an election.
Yeah.
And it's going to be very decisive,
yes,
on a variety of issues, including the estate tax.
But still, I mean, isn't it true what I said, that for 2 years, though, the Democrats controlled everything and could have, with a stroke of the pen, made all these tax cuts go away and go any tax rate they wanted to, really, yet didn't do it. I mean, isn't that telling?
It is, because there are prominent Democrats that want the exemption to be high. They do not want to go back to a low exemption.
And that's for their personal reasons. I mean, their own estate reasons.
Their own estate reasons, but also because they have prominent, wealthy supporters of themselves that want the exemptions to stay high.
These guys would like to get reelected.
And the battle is not over so much the exemptions as it is over the rates. Will the rate stay at 35%, or will it rise to 50% on the excess?
Wow.
And that's where the battle is going to be fought. So if somebody tells you that they know what's going to happen, that person is probably not telling you the truth.
Yeah, we just don't know all the time here. If we knew, we'd have some magical powers, and we wouldn't be here talking to you. We'd be out doing something else.
So I tell my clients, just don't worry about it. We don't know what's going to happen. The best predictions that I have heard is probably nothing's going to change till after the election, and we get a new administration and a new Congress in place. The cuts will probably fall in place and will come down to a $1 million exemption come January 1,
mm-hmm,
but the new Congress will then pass a law that will be effective retroactively, And so nobody's going to be paying taxes at the exemption level of $1 million.
Now, here at KLUP, they tell us that on a good day, and the wind's blowing right, that someone in Louisiana might be able to hear us. But in general, our listeners are in Texas. Are there any Texas taxes or penalties for dying that we need to know about?
No. No, we do not have a Texas estate tax or a Texas inheritance tax that applies.
God bless Texas.
Yeah, God bless Texas.
Yes, that's a wonderful thing. And we're also blessed as Texans that we have very good probate rules for Texas decedents. We were blessed since the days of the Republic that they put in very good probate rules providing for independent administration.
Well, now I'm a little confused because this is not my area of expertise, although it looks like that Texas and even the federal government won't have their finger in the pie for most of us in the event of death. They're still going to be involved in some way?
Well, if a person passes away and they have property, then there's probably going to need to be a probate of that decedent's estate.
Where the state oversees the distribution and makes sure that it's going to where the will stipulates, or in the event of no will,
yes,
the way the state stipulates.
That's a good summary of what happens.
So they oversee, but they don't get a piece of the pie.
Correct. Well, they get.
You're smiling. So, under what circumstance do they get a piece of the pie?
Well, if you have to go to the probate court, you got to pay filing
there
fees.
You go. Okay.
But they're nominal. They're a little over $200. They're not a huge amount.
Okay. Well, I've always heard, and in fact, I'm going to sound like an idiot. I do have a family trust because I always heard that I needed to have a trust in order to keep the state out of my affairs in the event of death, we could avoid probate. And now I'm thinking, so why do I have a trust? If really there's, why do I, it's now, see, I told you I was going to sound like an idiot. Glenn, why do I have a trust?
Well, some states, it's helpful to avoid probate for a decedent's estate. In Texas, we have good probate rules for decedent's estates. And so generally, most people have a will rather than a trust.
Well, then in my defense, let me point out that we had the trust drawn up when we lived in California.
California is what we call a bad probate estate.
Reason number two, folks, on this week's show alone, why we left California.
Yes. So California is one of those states. But generally in Texas, we have we use a will rather than a revocable management trust as the main estate planning instrument.
Okay. Well, that's convenient. That's nice. That's easy.
Yeah.
And look, I'm going to throw you a softball. When should people have a will drawn up?
When they're living.
That's good advice, before they die. I like that. You know, okay, we kind of established that, at least in Texas especially, that the government probably won't be our problem when we die. But you were talking to me, you're telling me some horror stories about where in the event of a death, sometimes the heirs, the estate's worst enemy, are other members of the family.
Yes, I have a friend who refers to probate court as a sibling divorce court. That's where they get separation from each other. Yeah, you want to plan your will so your family is not fighting over your estate. And that's what I do when I have clients come in. I try to identify if this is going to be a family that's going to fight over the estate. And then I try to identify those things they might fight over.
You mean which pieces of merchandise or property, personal or real property?
Yes, it could be. Like if they have a family business, are they going to fight over who's going to control the family business? That might be an issue we need to get resolved. Or if they have a ranch, are they going to fight over who's going to control the ranch? Or are they going to fight over the division of the property in the home? We want to find out do the children in the family get along? Now, that's in a traditional family where we have one marriage and one set of children.
I see where this is going.
Things get really complicated when we have a blended family. That's a family where we have the husband and the wife they have a marriage, but we have children from a different marriage.
Sure, we all know what that means.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you do once it goes bad?
Yeah, and what we try to do in those type of situations is we try to establish where property goes to the children, maybe, and not all to the spouse of a second marriage, that we provide for the children of the first marriage. Otherwise, they may not get any inheritance. And we certainly don't want to put the children of one marriage in the same trust as the spouse of another marriage. That is just asking for trouble.
Sounds complicated.
Yeah, you can see that.
But couldn't all of that be avoided if people just have nice, complete wills that they write?
If they write?
Oh, not that they write.
I mean, no, that's not really what I meant. If they have nice, complete wills that are very thorough.
Yes.
And that's where you come in.
That's where I come in.
Because you've seen it done the wrong way a lot of times, I bet.
Yes, I've seen it done the wrong way. And so I try to walk them through. So hopefully when one of them is gone, that there is not a fight among the family. That's not to say that everybody's going to be happy when they're gone with the way the estate is distributed, but there's hopefully not going to be a fight at the probate court.
Yeah, you can't make people happy, but you can help prevent fights, right?
That's what I try to do.
Yeah, you know, we have an interesting situation. In my will, my estate attorney recommended that in the event of my death, and Adam's 30 now, but he said in the event of my death, that Adam doesn't get a lump sum of money, that it's put into trust for his care up to the age of 35. And once he's 35, he can have some money, because that he says if you give an 18 or a 21-year-old kid a lot of money, you might as well give him a loaded gun and tell him to go out and shoot himself.
Yes, I often see where we would put funds in a trust and then have it distributed out over a period of time, say half at or maybe a third at 25, another third at 30, and then the rest at 35. The idea being that the individual received that first third, and then they may make some bad decisions with it, but they haven't blown of it. And then maybe they'll make better decisions with that next third, and then they'll make the really good decisions with the remainder of it.
My father so trusted me and my four sisters that he stipulated age 60. He said, whatever you do with your lives, at least when you're old and you can't work anymore. Well, I'm 60. I turned 60 last Sunday. But when you're starting to wind down, you might not have a lot of earning power. No matter what you did, at least you're not going to starve to death.
Yeah, you're not going to be out on the street, but you can't buy a new Porsche.
Well, Adam, I often recommend to parents that they put the property in trust for their children, for their life, for asset protection purposes,
really?
Because they can attach spendthrift protection to the trust. And that way, if their child gets in a toxic marriage, or they go into bankruptcy, or they get in an accident, and they have a lawsuit come against them, they won't lose what's in their trust, because it's in a spendthrift trust.
That's a good idea.
And so that is what the estate plan provides for any significant amount of money that might go to them, to provide that protection. That's the best asset protection plan that we can provide for our children for their inheritance.
That's really
interesting.
Wise. That's wise. You know, I know we could talk all day. I know we're going to take a commercial break in 2 minutes, but I want to get this in before we do that. You told me, you know, Adam and I are in the collectibles business, and you told me that you had some specific ideas about the disposal of inherited collectibles. And, of course, I'm hoping you say take it to auction at the jewelry exchange, but I got a feeling you're not going to say that. But what do you like to recommend to your clients when they inherited some collectibles? Maybe they don't know anything about the merchandise. What do they do?
Well, first of all, in the planning stage for the person who owns them, first they might want to designate in a memorandum to their family specific people that should get those.
Good idea.
And also, they should designate them specifically. But also, I recommend that they give some of the history of the item. In other words, if this is a ring from the decedent's grandmother, they should pass that history on to down to their family, because otherwise that's going to be lost to the family. And they should do that with all of the items, even if it's not an item that has maybe a particular monetary value. It's got great sentimental value. And that's something that needs to go down to the family, because I think that bonds the younger generation up to the older
generation. Yeah, Glenn,
generation.
We see that bond lost all the time. People bringing in things, they have no idea who their ancestors were, and they have no connection to it, no care.
Very often they don't care either.
No care whatsoever. Folks, we're going to take a short commercial break now. Then we'll return to open up the questions here on In the Money with our special guest, Glenn Yale of the Yale Law Firm, and Adam and me, David Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction and co-host of KLUP's In the Money. Every Saturday evening, thousands of people just like you join our live auctions in Stone Oak. New and estate jewelry at up to 80% off retail, including brand names like Tiffany, Rolex, and James Avery. Rare coins and currency far below coin shop prices. And name your own price for all sorts of collectibles and small antiques with different merchandise every week. Bid live in the gallery or through our internet simulcast and never pay retail again. It's all happening at the Jewelry Exchange and Auction each Saturday in San Antonio. Texas license number 16604. Member Better Business Bureau. Call 210-592-8786 or visit jewelryexchangeandauction.com. That's jewelryexchangeandauction.com. And join us every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. for In the Money right here on KLU.
You're back with David and Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction on In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? We received an email question that I think is perfect for the discussion we're having here today. Shed a little new light on something we haven't talked about. Here's the question. I just inherited a whole house full of stuff. About half of it is antique and collectible. The other half has deep sentimental value, but is mostly just household stuff. Is there someone who can help me get fair market value for all this stuff en masse? Because I don't want to take the emotional journey of going through all of Dad's stuff. And let's just call the sender anonymous. Glenn, I'm guessing you have something to say about this.
Yes, there are estate liquidators who will come into the home and they will conduct an estate sale. And you may see signs if you live in San Antonio where they're conducting an estate sale that day. And that's where someone has had an estate liquidator come in to dispose of those items that the family doesn't want. Sometimes they will take the items, if they're of particular value, to the store that estate liquidator might operate.
Or the auction house.
Or the auction house, yes. You could take them to the auction house and they can be sold there. Yes, if you don't want the items, there are people that can help you get the full value from those items. And then you can keep the items that have particular value that you want to retain.
Yeah, the last sentence of this email, I don't want to take the emotional journey of going through all of Dad's stuff. I've been doing this for 33 years. I know you've been in this business for a while. You know, I have all the sympathy in the world for the sender of this email, and I understand he doesn't want to take that emotional journey, but in my opinion, somebody has to do that. I don't know is there anybody on earth who doesn't have any little thing that they wouldn't want somebody to see if they go through all the effects, some personal property or memorabilia, or maybe some horrible stuff on the computer, for example. And I can't imagine that you just let an estate person come in and take the computer until somebody with some loving concern for the deceased goes through and says, maybe we ought to reformat the hard drive first, something like that.
Yes, you really need to go through everything. And that's something that is a caution to individuals amongst the living here, is that when we die, somebody's going to be going through everything.
Let's just call it dirty laundry.
There's nothing
hidden. We won't say pornography collection or anything.
that stuff that's on the back shelf
there
in the closet?
Go. There you go.
It's going to be found.
And we see estates, too, where people have just a whole mass of gold coins, and you don't want just some stranger to stumble
knew.
On that.
Nobody
And nobody
knew.
Knows about it. They can just take it if they want.
Oh, and that... That happens all the time. I see reports from attorneys where sometimes there's dishonesty in the business where they liquidate, and it's a shame.
Yeah, you know, Glenn, the music means we're out of time. We do want to thank you for coming joining us here this week. It's incredible how fast this goes.
It's been a delight.
But look, we're going to be back next Saturday at 7 a.m. Our new program, Dealing Small, will welcome our very special guest, Pamela O'Neill from Pamela's Parlors, and we're going to be taking questions on buying and selling in a small space or in no space at all. If you have questions, call us at the Jewelry Exchange, 210-592-8786. Or email questions@inthemoneyradio.com. We'll answer every single question. We'll take the best ones on the air. Hey, you can be a radio star, too. We hope to see you all tonight at our live auction at the Jewelry Exchange in Stone Oak. And we hope you'll join us next week for In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? Thanks for joining us this morning. Have a great week.